Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, we're excited to have Mike Banik. Mike is the Vice President of Marketing at Vectra. With more than 20 years of experience in the networking industry, he brings a practical understanding of how technology can solve business problems. Previously, he was the Vice President of Global Marketing for Networking at HP. He joined HP from Juniper, where he served as a number of executive positions, making significant contributions toward growing the company's enterprise revenue and market share. His networking experience includes Vice President of Marketing at Terabyte Networks and Trapeze Networks, and product management roles at Rhapsody Networks, Extreme Networks, and 3Com. Mike holds a BSEE from Worcester Polytech Institute in Massachusetts, and previously served on the board of the Ronald McDonald House at Stanford. You can get him and see him on Twitter at mbanik, that's B-A-N-I-C, and the website is vectra.ai. Before I get into anything else, I just want to thank you, Mike, for joining us from Australia today. It's quite early, it's 7 o'clock, 7 a.m. there. So thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Sue.
Yeah. And I also need to say that Mike and I go way back. I mean, I don't even know how long it's been, probably 12 years or something. And he is one of Mariposa's clients, former clients. And, you know, I get to do this probably once every other year where we get a client to come and join us on these calls. I mean, mostly we're having people who are positing about their books and all these kinds of things and on their consultants and such, and that's fine. We love them too, but it's a treat for me to not only have somebody who's inside, but somebody who I know well and who I appreciate. So I really am glad that you're with us today. Thank you so much.
That's an honor.
Okay. So when we start out these conversations, I ask the same question of all my guests, and that is that about your journey. I mean, I read the bio, which is very impressive, and you've been at a lot of really cool networking companies. And but I also like to hear from you about your journey, what led you to Vectra, and particularly why you decided, because it's been like how many years have you been at Vectra? Like 4 or 5? Now?
5.5.
Yeah, 5.5. Gosh, it's like, it's amazing how long it's been. Okay, so AI then was like, you know, it was Google algorithms. We didn't really know much about it as much as we know now. So how did you decide you were ahead of the game to have gone to a company like that so soon? And they were very small. So I want to hear a little bit about that journey and how you decided to go there and what's happened since. Let us know that.
So getting to Vectra kind of started the way a lot of us choose positions, which was I wanted to work with people that I knew and respected and wanted to spend 10 to 12 hours of my day with.
Sure.
And so I'm working with a CEO that I worked for before. He was our general manager at the switching business at Juniper, and our CTO is, he was the CTO of the security business at Juniper, and that was my gravitational pull. And I have to admit, much like probably a lot of people on the call, when I sat down and they were explaining what they did with machine learning, they didn't even use the term AI at that point.
Right.
I was a little dazed. My eyes kind of glazed over a little bit. And what really got me was the outcome. And it was when the CTO, Oliver Tavakoli, walked me through the mock-ups of what the user experience was going to be like. Mm-hmm. And that's when my light bulb moment occurred. When I looked at it and saw, oh, you're providing incredible clarity. Yeah, this is what's in your software is a very complex black box, but the outcome is just so clear, so easy for somebody to understand, and you're really truly putting the details of what somebody needs to do to make effective decisions right at their fingertips. And to me, that was the tipping point. And I think we've really stayed true to communicating that outcome as we message ourselves in the market. But, I'll admit, we have kind of ridden the marketing curve with AI along the way a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, which is great. So I also start out with these conversations this year, because this year we've been talking about AI and society and AI and business, particularly. I've I've made sure that for people on the call that, you know, are just bringing themselves into the idea of AI, I want to kind of do a quick primer. So you mentioned machine learning. Could you give us a quick primer on what machine learning is, what AI is? And there's, you know, in my mind, there's three different types of AI. Could you just talk a little bit about that before we get started into some of the marketing applications?
Sure. So, you know, the best thing to do is kind of visualize, you know, concentric circles. You know, AI is a really big, broad topic, and so it's the outermost concentric circle. And, you know, within there are a lot of different technologies. And the best way for people to think about AI is how it was defined in 1955 by a group of people that had proposed a research project for the summer at Dartmouth. And they said that artificial intelligence is defined when you make a machine behave in a way that would be called intelligent if a human were behaving in the same manner.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
You know, so we use different technologies to get the machine to do that. And machine learning is one of them. So machine learning is one of those inner concentric circles. And then within machine learning, there's a couple categories that everybody on this call may hear from time to time. And it's important to maybe demystify them. You know, there's things like supervised machine learning, unsupervised machine learning, and deep learning. And they're not apple, you know, we have two apples and an orange there. You know, so supervised and unsupervised, you know, clearly those are opposites. The basic easiest way to understand supervised is it's trained on labeled data. So, you know, if you build an algorithm that uses supervised machine learning, it simply starts working effectively the moment you turn it on. And you can use those types of approaches because the problem you're trying to solve is going to be consistent across every environment that you put it in. And unsupervised machine learning is going to work on unlabeled data, and it requires a training period. And the reason why the folks who build these things result to that is they don't have all of the information, which is actually one of the fun things about this industry is the people building this stuff are used to dealing with incomplete data. Anyway, unsupervised machine learning is going to always require a training period. And probably the easiest thing for the average person on the street to remember is if you hear unsupervised machine learning, think about finding anomalies, because that's usually the biggest use case for it. And you know, the tough thing when you're finding anomalies, you're sometimes producing a fair bit of noise. You're producing detections that may not necessarily be bad things. It's like telling somebody to walk through Times Square and find everything that's an anomaly. You'll come back with a lot of anomalies, but they're not necessarily all harmful things. Now, when it comes to that third term, deep learning, the reason that's the orange with the two apples, with the context of supervised and unsupervised, there's this notion of deep and shallow. So there's some really basic methods like k-means and DB scans that you can use for supervised and unsupervised techniques. But then there's really advanced, deeper things that you can do, like recurrent neural networks and long short-term memory. And those are deep learning techniques, but you can use those for both unsupervised and supervised models. And so those are just, you know, keywords to think about. And to me, the funny thing about the AI industry, it's a lot like medicine. You know, with medicine, it's, you know, there's some characteristics that are consistent between medicine and AI. We don't know everything yet. We're constantly learning. It's quickly evolving. And the people who are in those two sectors are basically practicing. You know, practicing is that, you know, we learn from what we find. We don't have all the complete data, so we have to be open to new things as we go. And so the people who are practicing AI are data scientists. And so those data scientists come from all kinds of interesting walks of life. When we hire them, there weren't necessarily degree programs in universities to become a data scientist. There are today, but they started their process as, you know, mathematician, getting PhDs in statistical theory, or physicists or biologists, and they're just very good at applying math and science and statistical models in order to predict information from data, and that can be applied to a lot of different
right.
a lot of different missions.
So I want to get a little bit higher level, and because I want to get some examples too. But so what you just described in terms of supervised and unsupervised and deep learning is still part of narrow AI, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to, because I want to distinguish between narrow, general, and super, because I think that sometimes when people are talking about AI, they get you know, they're talking about robots, and they're talking about, you know, robots are coming, and, you know, they're taking over, and we're a long, 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 long way away from that. And that's where generalized AI, yeah. So most of the AI that we know and we use is like just, you know, algorithms and with Google and such. So targeted marketing, those things are all still narrow AI. You know, playing chess, can you beat the other chess player who's a machine essentially? Still narrow AI. So could you just explain a little bit about the difference between narrow, general, and super AI real quick?
Wow, actually, I probably can't really quick, because I want to make sure I do it in a way that's really simple, and I didn't prepare for that.
Oh, no,
and I don't want to leave the audience more confused than when they started.
Oh, no, it's okay. I mean, I guess I just want to make sure people understand that what we're talking about mostly and what we're going to be talking about is narrow AI, and that it's more the application that makes things basically, like you talked about medicine, it's like, you know, how do we understand cell regeneration, and we can do that much faster with AI than sitting, you know, than doing it with human capacity. So we can get data faster, as an example. Marketing, you know, we can get data, we can target and understand people's preferences faster with AI. Where general intelligence is more merely, it's more where humans are. I mean, the machine is more like a human in more facets, especially, you know, showing emotion, those kinds of things, which, again, we're not there yet. And then super AI is that it goes beyond human intelligence, and that's where it gets a little scary in terms of, especially when you're talking about applications to war and things like that. So that's, I guess, the quick version of those three things.
That works for me.
That works for you? Okay. So what I want to spend most of our time on, because of your expertise, is if you could explain some examples, and you can use supervised and unsupervised, but I'm more interested in, like, the application of either of those to the marketing realm, and both from a consumer's perspective and from a business person's perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if I just focus on uses of AI and marketing, you know, because people try to sell me these things, I'll start with one that I think has a lot of room to grow, which is, yeah, you know, trying to predict buyer behavior. I think this is actually one of the toughest things for people applying AI techniques or machine learning techniques in order to achieve. And, you know, one of the things that I like to think about is if I'm going to try to predict where a vast number of people in the marketplace are going to go next, what's their next move,
mm-hmm,
what's their behavior going to be, I actually need to do something very similar to what Google did with their AI to win AlphaGo. And so they use deep learning in order to do that. And the thing about deep learning is when you're using a deep learning technique, whether it's a recurrent neural net or long short-term memory, you actually need a tremendous amount of data in order to train it. And even when you do that, the human being can make a divine decision, which is code for a completely unpredicted decision. And that's what happened when Lee Sedol, you know, beat AlphaGo in the fourth game, or won AlphaGo in the fourth game, back in 2016. And with human beings, we find that every day. People make these divine decisions. A simple one, you could be shopping for, you know, somebody's Christmas gift, and somebody could be watching all of your online behavior, They could be watching credit card data of the things that you're buying, you know, throughout the holiday season. And, you know, then out of the blue, you talk to a friend you haven't heard from for 5 years, and you talk about this common friend that you're just, like, stuck. You have no idea what to buy them. And in the middle of that conversation, you're reminded of something, and you have this divine inspiration of, oh, now I know exactly what I'm going to get them. The AI cannot interpret that. And so when I look at the solutions that are available to us as marketers, there's the people who are building them, they're really qualified people, and they're very good at what they do, but they're facing a tough challenge, which is you need to have an immense amount of data, which needs to be shared with you from the marketplace. And then there's still this challenge of these divine inspirations, which, you know, human-only traits like creativity cannot be right now mimicked in a machine. And I think that that's probably one of the toughest challenges for people in the science, but I think it's also one of the greatest benefits to us as a human race, because, you know, technology is great, but it should be applied in a way that actually makes all aspects of our life better, not just the buying decision, but, you know, how we spend our day. And right now, the things that we produce in our livelihood are a big part of where we get a sense of self. And to take that away from human beings would actually be very life, you know, very world altering.
Right. So, I mean, there's a thing called judgment, right? So I think that, companies that, you know, have face recognition software, I mean, it's not perfect. So they still have to have somebody there to sort of, what's the word I want?
High context.
It's like, this is for security, right? And so they still have to have somebody to sort of verify is the word I'm trying to find. So it's not perfect. And same with any judgment. So that's why I see, I actually am envisioning sort of like the machine and the person sitting next to each other.
Because it's a very perfect vision to have, actually. And it's actually something that's really core to what we do, which is everything that we present as a, we call it an incident or a detection. We also provide a help file with all the information that's there that says, these are the potential root causes, and here are the steps to verify. And if you take no action, here are the potential business impacts. And that human verification is really, really critical. And to kind of bring an everyday example together with this, let's say we have a detection that some behavior occurred in the network, and we've determined that's an attacker behavior. It's a lot like when the flash goes off at an intersection because somebody went through a red light and a photograph was taken. Now, you're what you said about a human next to the machine, this is very much what happens in this instance of the photograph taken at the red light being run. It's, you know, it has to go through somebody's desk at the police department. Mm-hmm. That person has to look at it, and they have to determine, was this an ambulance responding to an incident, which is in policy behavior. It's allowed behavior. Mm-hmm. And or was it somebody looking down at their mobile phone, a distracted driver? They deserve to get a ticket. And that's where, you know, we can, you know, the camera going off, that was all automated. AI is just simply to automate something that we just don't have enough humans in the world to do or can't afford to do. And, you know, so we put, you know, a loop wire in the road, and we put a camera and a flash and, you know, connected it to a network to send the photograph back to the police department. That was all automation. The human next to the machine is actually making the final decision, and that's a really critical step in a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about Vectra. So, you know, obviously you're doing cybersecurity, and you're looking at threats. And so you started talking a little bit about how AI has changed the game in cybersecurity. If you could tell us a little bit more about that would, I think that would be interesting for people to hear.
Sure. So in the security market, there's a lot of tools that people use today. And for the most part, what those tools have all been done is to stop the initial incursion, basically the attacker getting in the door. And, you know, I think maybe, you know, 6-7 years ago, there was a belief that a lot of chief information security officers had, which is, oh, yeah, we have the best security architecture. You know, we can't be breached. And I think the turning point was when when Target was breached in Christmas shopping season of 2013. And, you know, we've really seen a pivot where people realize, yeah, I have no way to defend myself if attackers get in. And that's really what our role is in the cybersecurity market, is to not stop them from getting in. There's plenty of tools people already bought for that. Our job is to find the evidence that they're present when they get in. And,
right.
You know, the way everybody's always thought about this before was, I have to be perfect all of the time. And unfortunately, there are these flaws in the system. And we see these in the news. You know, ransomware occurred because there's a flaw in Microsoft software that went back to Windows 95. Well, those flaws, the attacker just has to find one flaw and he can get in. And what we like to do is, you know, we tell people, look, we are going to force the attacker to be perfectly hidden all the time, because we have all these different machine learning models that can find the behavior of what the attacker has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if we find enough of those, we can prove to you that they're there and you can stop them before they actually steal information for your customers. And put your business at risk. The cool thing about this is we actually can present this in terms of what's the workload reduction for your team, because all these people that are working in cybersecurity are pretty overworked individuals, and the burnout rate for level one security analysts is pretty high. It's around, you know, people, if they stay in a job for more than a year, it's kind of a big deal. You know, their bosses are, hey, you're here for the second year. And, you know, we find that we've got customers that we've got some videos of on our website. And when you ask them, so what's it like using the software? It's like, well, we started to have a lot of fun, you know, doing the following things. And it's like, well, they never used to use the word fun before. Before it was drudgery work. And it gave us this idea, you know, let's poll people at conferences. And we took a poll at Black Hat. We said, well, what do you want to do less of? And the overwhelming vote out of 800 plus people was, I want to spend less time triaging security alerts, which means, you know, I get a message that something bad happened over here. Go find out what was the bad thing and was it really bad? And
mm-hmm.
I want to spend more time doing threat hunting, which is I get a full-blown incident report from a junior analyst. And, you know, now I'm gonna put on my forensic investigator hat, a lot more like a CSI investigator. And
before it
I'm
happened.
Using...
Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Go ahead. Finish. Yeah.
No, and you know, that workload reduction results in better productivity and better safety.
Yeah, well, better morale. It sounds like. I'm wondering, as you were talking, I was thinking about the idea of how do we fight the next. So there's, of course, all these wonderful things that are positive about AI in terms of how we can get data quicker, and certainly applications to health and medicine and such. But there's also the bad guys, so to speak, can use AI to threaten us more. So I would assume that part of what you're having to do as your company is trying to, like, fight AI with AI, right? Does that make sense?
It does. And there, it's funny. Part of the reason I'm in Australia is Gartner had their security and risk management conference here Monday and Tuesday. And, you know, one of the analysts, Anna Bellick, talked about, you know, attackers using AI. There's actually some
right.
easily searchable examples of this. And the fact of the matter is AI, or at least machine learning models, are things that automate traditionally routine, mundane manual processes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so... The attackers are human beings, and human beings, you know, I'll admit, we all like to be lazy if we find the fastest path to the outcome we can. And if they can use a machine learning tactic in order to accelerate a process or take work out of the system, they're definitely going to do that. It's not necessarily adversarial AI in the Skynet kind of approach, which is that much more general AI. They're not going head-to-head per se. It's just that... you know, your overall cyber defenses are going against an adversary who's got some automation tools similar to the ones
right.
that you do.
Right.
But just so that everybody has hope, you know, the reality is that most of what an attacker does once to use these techniques is really on the intrusion part. Most of the advances that we see are on, you know, finding new ways to get in the front door or in the back door or through a window. And once they get in, though, they haven't changed what they do on the inside for, you know, the last 10 years. There was another analyst here, Craig Lawson, who actually talked quite a bit about that. And, you know, so the advances that we've been bringing actually uncover all those tactics and things that they have to do. And unfortunately, they can't really change them too much. And it's because of the way networks are built and the fact that every network today runs on the Internet Protocol. And so between TCP/IP and UDP/IP, there's, you know, pretty tight lines on the road and that they can't stray from. And that actually benefits us.
Interesting. So let's talk about some of the fears. I mean, this is, I think, one of the biggest issues that we've been, this is our you know, eighth session, if you will, for the year. And a lot of people want to know about generalized AI. I mean, they want to know, like, how close we are. And if you, like, let's start with, do you think that this automation, so, you know, very simply, AI can automate. You know, it's like, if I could get somebody to, you know, do my calendar, so I don't have to do it, and Alyssa doesn't have to do it, I mean, I would love that. So if it's a machine versus a person, I know there's some things out there, but they're not perfect. But that would be one example. And my belief also is that, okay, fine, so the AI or the machine can do the mundane things, and they can do other things. So it's not like their job goes away. It's just that part of their job goes away. So tell me kind of what you've been thinking about in this realm, because I know you're a thinker about these things, from any angle you want. Just kind of where are you at with this stuff?
Yeah, we are a long way away from it. I think that I tend to be a pragmatic thinker. One of the things that needs to be done is to improve the efficacy of a lot of the automated techniques that we have today. So one example people bump into a lot is, you know, self-driving cars, right? So,
right.
And even
right.
If you use the autopilot mode on, you know, on a car that you can buy today, you know, the most normal human reaction is people will question it. Even when they turn it on, they still sort of, the first time, have their hands hovering next to
right.
the steering wheel, and they're
right. Need a pound.
right. It's what you said before. You know, it's like you need to verify these things. And you know, I think that we have a long journey ahead in terms of efficacy. And you know, we've experienced a couple AI winters in the past where, you know, we've had these plateaus where there's been no forward development, and then you know, and this existed with, you know, most recently with natural language processing, where hidden markup models were used for natural language processing for more than 10 years, maybe close to 20, and then all of a sudden, after 2012, people started to use recurrent neural nets and long short-term memory, and Siri became useful. And you know, they started using similar techniques, recurrent neural deep learning techniques in Google Translate, and lo and behold, it actually was incredibly effective, and you could barely tell the difference between what a human translated and what the machine translated. So we need to go through more periods with AI where more functions that are automated are highly effective. Probably the toughest thing is those divine thoughts, right? Those things that are unpredictable about the human brain. That because we're the ones teaching the machine to think, the way that this communication between brain cells and that communication path changes as we learn and develop. That's something that's still a great mystery in terms of how do we get the machine to mimic that so that the machine can be a self-teaching, self-evolving entity. And I have no prediction on when that's going to happen, but we'll probably have a couple plateaus in technical approaches between now and getting anywhere close to that.
What do you make of, I mean, you talked about the AI winter, which I think is a really interesting concept, because we're not in one now, clearly. I mean, it's interesting to see sort of how, if you look at the VC world, you know, how AI has become, you know, such a big part of what they're going for, and that wasn't the case even 2 years ago. I mean, this is, in the last 2-3 years, it's just blossomed or, you know, blown up or whatever you want to say. do you foresee that, can you make a guess as to, like, are we in this sort of really, abundant or fanatic, I don't know what word you want to use, period right now, and do you see another winter happening soon? I mean, I think from what I've read, it's like people think this is a different exuberance than it was in the past.
Yeah, this has been a very, this is sort of like the desert bloom after, the perfect rainfall in the winter. We've had a lot of technical advances, and it's, probably been brought on by the fact that we've had this long period of economic growth and education and different people in the world coming together from different places. It might be easier to talk about things that put it at risk. There's one thing that puts it at risk is just a lack of empathy on the side of the AI community. There are a lot of human beings in the world that, don't embrace this at the same pace that they do. And rushing people will actually cause minds to close.
Mm-hmm.
And,
point.
One of the other things that can cause minds to close, so this is another risk to this, is just what we're seeing in, the geopolitical climate, where people are, wanting to become, less open and more closed. And they, that actually could, drive a nuclear winter. I mean, I forget the author of the paper, but there was a paper that was published that basically reversed everyone's thinking on AI back in the first nuclear winter. And it wasn't technology that caused it or the lack of advance in technology, but it was people in closed-minded thinking. And
right.
So, there's people on both sides of that that need to be conscientious on the science side, empathy, and on the other side, it's, just take a little more time to understand.
Right. So I think there's different aspects of empathy. I mean, there's obviously shoving, what you said, like the AI community shoving it down the, throat of us and going too fast. There's that. And so having empathy for the people that need to understand. And on the other side of that, there's there's different types of empathy. It's like if one of the issues I can see is that we need to make sure that we continue to have as human beings, continue to realize that empathy and creativity to particular skills are super important and continue to be alongside AI as we become better, the machine gets better at learning, because that's really what we're talking about here. So it's can the machine learn faster, and that's what this whole thing is about. But as the machine's learning faster, can we still keep our empathy to judge what's going on? And I think that's where I think people are concerned. That's where I'm concerned, is we think it's been hard, in the last 10 years in terms of connection because of, the iPhone and Facebook and our distractions, okay? It's going to be even harder as the machine learns more. So that's another aspect of empathy. How do we ensure that we stay with our humanness in terms of the distraction of the machine? So what's your thought about that?
Yeah, one of the things you made me think of as I listened to you is how we treat the data that we're using.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has a profound impact on people's reaction. And I'll be specific. In our case, we need data in order to continue development. We have the vast majority of our the people who use our software share anonymized metadata with us. And we have a large number that share raw data with us. And so the raw data is, you can see everything. That is only shared with a very, very tight group of people. It's very tightly controlled. And as an executive in the company, I have no access to it because I have no right to see it. The anonymized metadata, the circle of access broadens out a little bit, but even even then, it's very tightly controlled. And I think that the way companies are perceived in terms of managing this very sensitive information that
mm-hmm.
says a lot
mm-hmm.
about how we're using tools or how people are using the cloud that is part of my, you know, enterprise
mm-hmm.
production or my enterprise
mm-hmm.
IT is super vital, because that helps to build trust.
Mm-hmm.
And with that trust, you get to go further in your advancement. And as the pace of that advancement is in such a way that it can be understood and consumed by people, then we can avoid a nuclear winter, or not a nuclear winter, an AI winter.
Yeah. Well, and you just mentioned something that's come up with us, and I'm sure that this, you guys are affected by this all the time. But like, we were asked by a company to make to look at our security around our data. It's the first time anyone's ever asked us, which I think was great. I mean, it's super hassle, right? Big hassle. However, you just little things like how many of us have data on our laptop that isn't on the cloud. So, because the idea is if it's on the cloud, it could be secured because it could be password protected and such, based on, you know, all the protections you guys, for example, can offer and other companies. But if it's on your laptop, it can't be protected. You know, someone could steal your laptop and they could hack in. So
mm-hmm.
so making sure, like, data, like, you know, our data is really personal to people. It's all about, you know, their 360s or whatever it is. And so making sure that whatever we're doing, taking it off our laptop, putting it as just a little example. But reason why I bring it up is because it's the first time anyone's ever asked us to. I mean, all of our stuff's on the cloud, so we're fine. But it's just interesting that that's now become something that people are wanting. And I think that a lot of that has to do with that, you know, there's been all sorts of publicity around privacy and security, right? And that as you are able to run a machine to run more data, there's just going to be more chance for security problems because you've got more data, right? So, I mean, what's the capacity of this? I mean, like, this is all on the cloud, right? This is all on, it's still somewhere. The cloud is still, do we run out of space, Mike, here, or how does this work? Networking guy?
We won't run out of space anytime soon. It is amazing, though, how much additional storage space is needed consistently every year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's plenty of data out there about, you know, how much data is generated on Facebook's platform. They stopped measuring, you know, hours and minutes, because it's just easier to focus on days and weeks. But it's an immense amount of data that does have to be stored someplace. And, so asking about data policy is something that happens for us a lot. There are mostly, you know, mid to large size organizations, smaller ones, they just may not have thought about that. And what happened to Capital One has actually caused a lot of new questions to come up.
Right.
Because, I think it's actually – Capital One is the poster child for using the cloud to build a digital business, and
mm-hmm.
those guys actually do a very good job. They
mm-hmm.
have their act together, and you know, there was a flaw in a web application firewall that allowed somebody who knew the system well enough that they could exploit that. And the thing that's a challenge I don't think many people in the industry have gotten their heads around is, in the Capital One case, the person actually was able to move around because they understood how privilege works. And for most, you know, for my parents, the whole notion of what is privilege, they don't understand it. You know, their view of the world is, I have a computer, I'm the owner of the computer, I must be the most privileged user on it. In the IT systems, and especially when you're a tenant in a cloud, think of it as an administrative plane or a management plane, where there are people who have very high levels of privilege and they can move around. And because when you call them and say, I'm having a problem accessing my data, or I'm having one of my workloads, I'm experiencing a problem with it. They're the ones who help you, and they can go in and they can do things
mm-hmm.
because they have all this level of privilege. It's in the cloud environment. this is going to become the thing I expect cyber attackers to use to their advantage more, because it's something that it's brand new. And you know, Capital One, their case was a wake-up call for, okay, how do we know if privilege is being abused in the cloud environment, and how do we know when, you know, privilege is crossing from the management environment into my virtual private cloud, and how do I know when that is for legitimate means of servicing a support request and when it's not?
Interesting. Obviously, you're a marketer. I'm just curious if you could give us a couple of examples of how your team is using AI to help your customers.
Yeah, one that's actually we're rolling out and is just around chat. And I've actually experimented with chat on different companies' websites in more of the B2C space.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm staying at a Hilton. I used Hilton's chat tool to do something, and I wanted to get a sense of, you know, did it reduce friction or increase friction? Because it's chat on a website falls into the meta frame of let's reduce the friction for the consumer and the buyer, because there's more resistance on the buyer's part to pick up the phone and actually call somebody, because I just want, if I call you and you know you're the salesperson for the company, You have your own mission. I just want to get the answer to two things, and you want to try to get me to buy something. And we as humans don't want that anymore. So the whole notion of chat is pretty good. So use of AI, it does. When it works.
Yeah. No, I mean in general, not yours. If it works well, yes. Yeah.
Using AI to reduce friction is a big theme. Another is just around automating our understanding of, you know, when is somebody truly interested? There used to be much more statistical related models where, you know, Sue visited Vector.ai and she read 6 pages and downloaded 5 things. She must clearly be interested. Well, Sue could be doing a research project for a class she's taking. And, you know, so it's actually looking at, it's actually stringing some intelligence together with what are the titles that you're reading? Are they thematically related? Does it represent an escalation in your level of interest? And, you know, it also makes your experience better, because then you don't have some pesky salesperson calling you when you're really a research student. And if you really have a problem, the person who does call you is actually going to ask you meaningful questions about the things that you're looking at and what that escalation in interest actually may mean. And they're not going to ask you 1,000 questions about stuff that's unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
Does have a double-sided effect and positive effect in terms of it makes things better for us, but it hopefully improves the consumer's experience on their side.
Right, right. Interesting. Awesome. Any last words, Mike? Again, just so interesting to talk with you about this stuff in terms of how AI is going to affect us.
I think the last thing I would want to leave people with is just, you know, there's this fear that AI is going to take over people's jobs, and my favorite human analog on this is when I watched the movie Hidden Figures about the women who worked behind the scenes on the NASA Apollo missions in the early 60s. You know, there were the light bulb moment for me was when they referred to a human being as a computer. I'm like, wow, never heard that before. And, you know, and the fact that they used an IBM to perform thousands of calculations in a minute that a human used to take hours to do, those humans went on to be the Fortran programmers that, you know, made the IBM do what it could do. I don't know that those people would have wanted to continue doing that same thing forever. At some point, they would have burnt out. You know, the whole idea of technology is automating something that's routine, that's rote, that's mundane.
Right.
It actually gives you an opportunity to, you know, have those divine moments and think of things and apply your uniquely human capability in a different way, and I think that's the best way to think of AI. It's not going to take something away from you. It's actually going to allow you to do something that you personally find more interesting.
Yeah, I love it. That's my viewpoint too. It's like it allows us you're using the word divine. I say creativity. It's just like it allows us to work on other things that only we can do, that the machine can't do. So thank you for that. That's a great way to end. So Again, you can get a hold of Mike through Twitter at M Banik, B-A-N-I-C, and the website for Vectra is vectra.ai. Thanks again for being with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you in general, but especially on this, so thank you.
My pleasure. It was fun.
Yeah, sure. So thanks, everybody. Back to school is here. Good luck with that, and we'll see you in a month or so. And Mike, again, good day, mate. Have a wonderful time down there, and safe trip back.
Good day.
Okay. Bye now. Bye, everybody.